evening, I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Recently, Pusat Komas, which is an NGO that advocates against racism and race discrimination, recently released the annual Malaysia Racism Report for 2022. Now, this is the 8th edition of the report that's being produced. It highlights different trends of racism and racial discrimination and xenophobia in Malaysia. Here to discuss the report in further detail is Dr. Ryan Chua. He is the Program Director at Pusat Komas, and here to help us understand the ongoing trends of racism and how to break them, we have Dr. Murni Wan Mohamad Noor. She is a senior lecturer at University Putra Malaysia. She's also a consultant in a team of researchers working on the Universal Periodic Review on Human Rights, focusing on the freedom of expression. The last time I interviewed her, she described herself as caring deeply for fostering racial unity and interfaith understanding. A pleasure to have you both here. Thank you so much for being on the show with me. I want to begin with you, Ryan, to kind of delve into this report. Let's jump head first, the Malaysia Racism Report for last year, 2022. It included this year, this edition included this special monitoring for GE15. Yes. That made the report quite meaty and interesting read, I might add. Can we talk a little bit about what you found from the monitoring and what was it in this annual racism report that stood out to you different from, say, the previous editions?
All right. Thank you very much, Melissa. I mean, it's glad to be back here again just to talk about this topic. So I think, first of all, before we delve deeper into the findings of the report, perhaps I thought it would be also good for me to set down the parameters of what actually constitutes the factors that were included into this report. So when we came up together in Komas, we decided that, you know, we need to come up with clear definitions, clear ways on how we define that issue to be racist, what is racial discriminatory, and what considers as xenophobia. So again, maybe just to give you a brief overview of what that is so that we can get a better contextualized understanding. So racism is an idea or theory of superiority of one race over the other. So it is used to justify or to promote racial hatred or any forms of discrimination. So again, if we assign a certain race or an ethnic group over the others, with the idea to exercise domination and control over the others, that falls under racism. So it includes like racist ideologies, prejudice, behaviours, structural arrangements and institutionalised practices which results in racial inequality.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Just to quickly interrupt you, I know that you're going through definitions, but why is it important that we define this? Are there groups of people who deny the existence of racism or discrimination? Why is it important to define these terms?
I think, again, anything can come into what we call as, you know, falls under racism, falls under racial discrimination. So we have these clear parameters to actually streamline and to really define it clearly.
For the purposes of monitoring and recording it.
Yes, correct.
Understood.
Yeah. So I think that is really important because there are also certain groups that decides that, you know, okay, whatever I'm saying, whatever I'm doing, it's not racist.
It's not racist. Yeah. I've heard that before. It's a joke. It's not racist.
So it, to a certain extent, it shows that inherent prejudice behavior. But, you know, but what they then say that, you know, okay, it doesn't fall under this definition, so it's not racist. You know, whatever I'm claiming, certain things like protecting my ethnicity, it's not racist. You know, that there are groups that actually claim that, you know.
Yes.
But when we look through this definition, then we can see, okay, when you use that idea, the prejudice behavior and that specific ideas into and to perpetuate and to have that racial inequality, that itself falls under racism. Mm-hmm. So that's the first part in terms of what racism is. Actually very general, right? So when we go into racial discrimination, it's more in terms of any distinction, exclusion, restriction or preference based on base, which hinders and nullifies one's prospects of getting equal treatment. Mm. So that falls under racial discrimination. And I have to make it clear that, you know, special measures like affirmative action does not fall under that because it has its intended purpose to advance and to give a certain ethnic group to go up that social ladder or the socioeconomic ladder. And that is not deemed as racial discrimination.
Under this definition.
Yeah, under this definition. Actually, it's based on the international standards of ICERT. Okay. All right. So but when such special measures are done and maintained, and it creates the distinction between the different rights of different ethnic groups, And once that objective or that special measure is not met, you know, it's met, sorry, then it shouldn't be continued. So whatever measures that were done then would then fall under racial discrimination. So it's very clear in that way where we identify what constitutes as racial discrimination, and when affirmative action comes into play, what are the parameters that falls under that.
Right. And the last one was xenophobia,
yes,
right?
Correct.
Very quickly. Okay.
So xenophobia is basically just based on a discrimination, based on a perception that that person comes from somewhere out of our country, and then they are actually treated differently just because of their notion of their
nation.
So
we often talk about xenophobia in terms of refugees and migrants, and that's the recipient of most xenophobic comments. Okay, now we've got the definitions laid out. Biggest trend that you saw last year?
So the biggest trend that we have identified, because this is our 8th year of monitoring incidents of racism, racial discrimination, and xenophobia, is actually based on the highest number of incidents that were recorded even in the past 8 years is the use of race and or religious politics in all of these conversations.
Okay, sorry, repeat that again. Last year saw the highest number of instances of...
Based on the 8 years of monitoring.
Okay.
So a total of, if I'm not mistaken, a total of 84 number of instances or incidents of racism. That had, 82 number of incidents compared to the past 8 years of monitoring. So that's the highest number.
Okay, so it's broken records, racism records last year.
Yeah.
Quite a disconcerting thing. Dr. Maria, I'm going to bring you in, Murni. When you think about that, the idea that last year, Pusat Komas recorded the highest number of racism incidences, right? How would you say, what has been significant in terms of the ongoing trends of racism, particularly in Malaysia?
Right. Well, if we're talking about last year, then it is not surprising that we see this increase, because racial and religious matters have been used by politicians from different corners to increase their chances of success at the polls. And so this is what many people call politics of fear. They use political rhetoric that centers on fear, particularly on racial and religious issues, in order to, you know, pull votes towards them and maybe perhaps discourage voters from voting for the other party. And it is not a clear-cut right, and well, it's not a clear to see who is perpetrating more, because from my observation, and I've been doing this for about 8 years now or 10 years now, almost all segments of political parties, well, not all people, but different corners of political parties adopt this kind of strategy. And it's difficult to monitor fully, because it would involve having to also participate or attend rallies in which they hold and sometimes embed hate speech within their campaigns.
Right.
And if it's done in different languages, it's also difficult to monitor. So what we're seeing and what Pusat Komas has observed is really just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more that we haven't uncovered, and that's the thing that worries me the most.
Okay. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, in fact, actually, we did have a monitoring of the whole GE15, and actually, we have some numbers here as well.
Okay.
So, of course, the three trends that we've identified, you know, because when we go into race and religious politics, there are also different strategies that are used. So, one of them is more in terms of, like, you know, we are here to represent this particular race, particular religion. Then, of course, fear-mongering, like what Dr. Mooney has mentioned. And lastly, it's also in terms of, like, my race or religion is more superior than the other. And from this data that we've identified, we have found out that, you know, Perikatan Nasional, to a certain extent, has used the highest number. I don't deny that, you know, other political parties themselves have played. In fact, all the political parties that we have identified had actually played the game.
Right.
In fact, Harapan has also, you know, politicians like the current minister now, Ngah Kong Ming, has also been found, you know, using this kind of sentiment. So, again, but now, when we look through the trends in detail, this is rather interesting. You know, when it comes to racial or religious representation, Barisan Nasional scores the highest as compared to all the other groups. But when it comes to fear-mongering, Perikatan Nasional scores the highest, meaning that, you know, if this group wins, what happens next?
Okay.
You know, so it's this kind of methodologies and strategies that have been used, as what Dr. Mooney has mentioned. It is there to help gather more votes and say, you know, I'm there to be the champion of your ethnic group, I'm there to be the champion of a religious group.
I'm just curious to know, why last year was so bad compared to all the other years. We've had elections before, we've had changes of government before. What do you think were some of the drivers of this kind of sentiment beyond the fact that it was a election setting?
Right. So with every general election that we have, these kind of sentiments are always going to be increasing. Mm. And so if we have another general election, state elections coming up, we can probably see the same kind of incidences.
That's worrying,
it
right?
It is worrying.
Yeah,
But it's something that we need to expect. Mm. And for me, there are several factors that contribute to this, but among them is the increasing usage of social media. And now we have more platforms for social media. Before, it was predominantly Facebook and then Instagram and then Twitter. And now we have TikTok. And so different platforms are used by different demographics. Mm. And the observation of hatred on these platforms may also differ. And so on Twitter,
observations of hatred, you said?
Yes.
Okay.
So the trends of hatred on Twitter might differ from the trends of hatred you might see on TikTok, from the trends of hatred you might see on Facebook, and so on. Mm-hmm. And what's also concerning is the way that the media represents certain issues, publishes certain issues. My research has indicated that that would also impact how social media users react.
Okay. Let's elaborate on that a little bit. How does the media, either inadvertently or willfully, perpetuate racism right. through their reporting?
So I wouldn't say that it is always something that is done intentionally. Sometimes mm-hmm. it is something that's done inadvertently mm-hmm. or unintentionally, but with emphasis on a particular narrative over and over again, dominant narratives, and with the usage of certain words in publication which is not culturally or religiously sensitive, mm. it may instigate or perpetuate more hatred in the comment section. And so from my analysis of thousands of social media comments posted with posted as a response to
a
news
article, okay,
we can see this trend. And so the way that newspapers report on a particular issue is very important. That's not to say that the newspaper articles cannot be critical. I mean, that is a major
the
duty
point of, it, yeah. mm-hmm.
the media. Mm. But in being critical, we can also be responsible and ethical in choosing our words, the images that we publish along with the headlines, and reduce certain stigmatization towards certain groups and so on and so forth. And this is also what perpetuated xenophobia against migrants and refugees, particularly in the last 2 to 3 years.
Right, yes. I'm recalling now certain instances of reporting that relate to what you're saying. Ryan, just very quickly, Dr. Ryan, I want to ask you about the monitoring of GE15. Well, actually, last year as a whole, and the instances of racism that happened last year, a majority were linked to politicians, whether they were on the stump, on the campaign trail, or just kind of grandstanding. A lot of that resorting to racial and religious rhetoric. What does it signal to you that politicians are the most guilty of doing this? How do we digest that?
I think we have to be fair as well. Okay. Apart from politicians, there are also specific individuals, specific groups. Of course, they are aligned to these political parties to a certain extent, but they are also responsible in terms of conveying such messages. So it's unfair to a certain extent to just blame that politicians are the most guilty. I mean, they are guilty, I'm not denying, but there are also other groups that continue to fan such issues. Mm. So again, we need to take into place that, there are also certain NGOs out there who are perpetuating and saying that, look, when you have certain initiatives, they will take it from the religious perspective. They take it from a racial perspective, even though it was a noble intention for all Malaysians.
So it was viewed through a racial lens,
religious
right?
You just
turn it into that racial angle.
Yeah. Okay. So there are, I think just a few days ago, there was a post that we found out that, there was this person from an NGO criticizing Manu Rathma. And then they were saying that, since they use the word Rathma, then they are not supposed to cover non-halal food. So I think to a certain extent, I mean, politicians themselves are guilty. But, of course, there are also certain other groups that are also part of it that continues to perpetuate such ideas. So I think, it's a big spectrum and everyone plays a role in this whole ecosystem.
Are there repercussions for those who do raise the ethno-religious temperature, who stoke those flames? What are the repercussions? Let's talk. I mean, do they get a slap on the wrist? Does the public hold them to account? What happens if someone says something that's clearly racial discrimination or racist, and does stoke those ethno-religious temperatures or flames? Dr. Mourni?
Well, you know, the problem with Malaysia's legal framework at the moment when it comes to matters of racism and hate speech is, number one, we don't have any definition for what hate speech is, and so that complicates things. So roughly we have about 14 separate legislations that can be used in different ways to curb hate speech. Mm-hmm. We still have the Sedition Act, it's still enforced today, although perhaps not many cases are charged at the court, but it's still there. We have Section 233 of the Communications and Multimedia Act. We even have Section 4 of the Elections Act, right, that is trying to reduce the likelihood of politicians and voters using the racial and religious cards in a negative way. Mm. But despite all these laws, we still have so many people engaging in hate speech. And so I see that, number one, the problem is our legislative framework at the moment is still weak. Okay. It's so ambiguous. For example, the definition of sedition, Section 233 is also very ambiguous. Anything that can be deemed as offensive could possibly be an offence.
But is legislation the right way to go? Do we want to punish? I'm trying to think about the balance because you work on freedom of expression, right? How do we want to kind of restrict that the freedom of expression, and how do we balance that with repercussions?
So that's a great question, and most people misunderstand when I talk about hate speech laws. It is not meant to be more restrictive, actually. The reason why many countries, many democratic countries, many Western countries have specific legislation on hate speech is so that it's become clearer and not so that it casts a wider net. It is meant to be something that people can clearly see, oh, this is something that's clearly hateful, and it can incite to hatred, it can incite to violence and things like that.
It's the ambiguity that makes it more difficult to define.
Okay. And that also perpetuates problems and unequal enforcement in the law and things like that, because when you cast a wider net, anything that can be deemed inappropriate or offensive may also be considered something that is against the law. And so in order to balance between freedom of expression and the right of the people to be protected against hate speech, these are the things that we need to consider. One, it has to come with legislative reform, but not to make things more restrictive. It is to make things clearer. And to adhere to law and order and the rule of law. But also, the legislative reforms is just one part of the story. The most important aspect for me would be through educational initiatives.
Okay, we're going to come back to that because that's a hugely important part of breaking the cycle, so that every year Ryan doesn't have to come out here and talk about the instances of racism that he's recorded. But Dr. Ryan, what do you think in terms of the repercussions? Do you think there should be repercussions for those who...
I agree with what Dr. Mourni has mentioned. In fact, this is something that's happening worldwide as well. So I think there are international standards like the Rabat Plan of Action, which helps to identify and what considers as hate speech and what is not. But locally and in Malaysia, I was thinking, and Komas has been also pushing for the idea of having a National Harmony Reconciliation Commission. The problem that we have now in Malaysia is that if there are issues of race and religion, you have issues, you feel offended, you go to the police.
Yeah, someone makes a police report, right?
Everything is just police report. So then the idea of the National Harmony and Reconciliation Commission, in fact, it was actually discussed. There was actually a commission that was being discussed to be established back then. And the idea was really to have a mediation area where, you know, when there are any grievances, any issues, they'll come to a mediation. Mm. And then there will be people who actually try to mediate, and then at the end they will try to reconcile. Mm-mm. And of course, there are also certain ways how this commission could then, you know, advise the government on how then do we curb issues of race and religion.
Okay. So isn't there a national unity? Isn't there a ministry, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes.
There's a Ministry of National Unity. Is that what we are? I mean, is it going to be solved at a federal level? Can a ministry really solve the problem of racism in Malaysia? So, to put it simplistically.
Commission and the ministry is two different things. Okay. So this commission is an independent commission.
Not under the federal ministry.
Yeah. So of course the ministry is responsible to, you know, of course, do education, public education, to also come up with enacting certain laws and policies. And in fact, you know, the Malaysian government for the past few years, they have a lot of like the blueprint, but a lot of them is just mere like bringing people together. It's very artificial in that sense. But the problem now is that, you know, like what Dr. Mooney has mentioned, you know, we need education. Why do we need education? I think we need to dig deeper into that. It's because there's lack of understanding about different ethnic groups. You know, a small thing that, you know, that takes place, you know, might be offensive to the others. Let me just give you an example. In one of the workshops that we have conducted recently, you know, this was between Ketua Kampongs, all right? And what happened then was that one of them actually asked an Indian person, you know, why do, whenever there's a Malay VIP going to an event, that Indian person would put that sekalong bunga around the neck. That is against my religion. And the Indian guy was like, wait, what do you mean? Because he's, then what he responded then was that he said, it's actually just, it's nothing religious about it. It's just putting a, what, as a sign of respect to the VIP.
Like a guest.
So, yeah, it's just two different things and they don't even understand, you know. And for to a certain extent, you know, when we say, okay, we do not serve pork in a certain places, let's also be fair to the other side. Why do in big jamuans and all that, you know, we serve beef where our Hindu friends can't taste them? So again, that kind of understanding, that kind of mutual understanding is not happening at this point in time. And it's also because of a lack of understanding, we don't really understand each other better. And we really live in a very segregated ways as well.
Well, there are efforts to kind of, you know, foster this national unity, but sometimes the efforts can feel quite superficial at the surface level. There's always an event and then it's all, you know, lots of, you know, big ceremonial
happy
event, but then you don't really get into the roots of the problem. And you think that education is the way we break the cycle of racism.
Right. Well, I don't know if we can fully eradicate racism, but I do know that education is a key aspect in at least preventing it from becoming more widespread. But when we think about education, most people think about educating the young, the children.
I think of school children,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah. But that's not it really. Of course, we need to educate the young, but who are the ones educating our children? It is also adults. And so if the adults are not being taught properly about the harms of racism, what is hate speech, how do we avoid from engaging hate speech, how are they then going to pass on this education of anti-racism effectively to the children? And so this effort to educate, it is not meant only for the young, but it is a multi-stakeholder approach for all levels of society.
How would we, just give me an example, how would we go about educating adults who, and I say this as someone who is very entrenched in her ways and views,
right,
how would you go about educating adults? The reason why we think of educating children is we think, oh, they're impressionable and moldable, and
right,
what would you, how do we even go about it?
There's so many ways that we can go about it, and so it needs to start, but it needs to start from somewhere. And of course, what we read and what we watch, what we consume are the things that shape our worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to have different ways to inculcate anti-racism education for the young and as well as our generation. And so books is a great way to do it. Arts and culture is another great way to do it.
Okay.
And this will slowly embed the ideas to different levels of society. So for example, in the children's book that I wrote on anti-racism education, it is not just geared towards the young children actually, but it's also for their parents and their teachers to actually get the message on how to inculcate these values within their children. And so it is not just for them, but it's also for the adults that are reading the books towards their children.
Can we speak about the importance of speaking up? Because that's another way to educate, right? Through peers, through community leaders.
Right.
So when you see, you hear a racist comment, something racist being done, you point it out. How do we create that culture of speaking up?
Well, I mean, if you look at our politicians themselves, there are some who are actually really strong against these issues of racism. But immediately what had happened to them, there will be an army of trolls attacking them immediately,
right,
saying, okay, why are you doing that, you know? You cannot promote.
There are repercussions to speaking up.
Yeah, there are many, in fact, you know. And I think one of the key ways when we talk about speaking up is let's try to look from the human rights perspective. It's really more in terms of someone's dignity, really, you know. you know, try not for us. I mean, one of the key things that Confucius likes to say, you know, do not do what you don't want others to do to you. And that's basically it, you know, really educating, raising awareness at the very level that, you know, if you don't want to experience discrimination, then don't discriminate. I mean, that's easy for us to say, right? And of course, you know, when politicians themselves, actually, we have a lot of vocal politicians who are speaking out. But the moment they say, okay, you are against our religion, you are against our ethnic group. So then, you know, and he who has been respected, for example, Prof. Ramasamy from Penang, you know, he was actually involved in, I think, drafting some of the important legislations for Aceh back then. He was revered. People felt that, oh, this is a very good example. But now you see, when he's speaking up on things, they say, oh, this is controversial. This is related to LTTE and all the causes. All kinds of baggages will then all be pulled and attacked on him. But in the actual fact, you know, he's just speaking in terms of we need equality for everyone and respect that person for being that person. That's all. It's their own dignity.
Right. How do you think we can address the fear, because there are repercussions to speaking, how can we address the fear and discomfort that comes with sometimes speaking up against racism and racial discrimination?
I think, one, we need to understand that it's not easy for everybody to speak up against it because, for example, the victims themselves, we must understand why they would feel fear. And research has indicated that that is why hate speech also robs a person from equality, because due to the fear of victimization and, you know, a backlash, they end up pulling away from society. And so other people who are in the capacity to help, they need to try to find their voice and be the voice of other people who are being oppressed. And so in the book that I have written, I'm also trying to show how young children can speak up for their friends, because sometimes if you don't see other people do it, then it's hard for them to emulate it themselves. And so these are the things, little lessons that we think is not going to be significant, but it actually goes a long way. And so we all can do something within our capacity to speak up for others. But of course, people with in fiduciary relationships or positions of power have a bigger role to play. They have, you know, the level of influence that they can use for the positive, and they can use that platform towards anti-racism education.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for giving me some food for thought today. I appreciate your time. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.